translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki? O King, wheresoever on the surface of the globe fell the semen of the great personality of Lord Shiva, mines of gold and silver later appeared. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that those who seek gold and silver can worship Lord Shiva for material opulence. Lord Shiva lives under a bale tree and does not even construct a house in which to dwell. But although he is apparently poverty-stricken, his devotees are sometimes opulently endowed with large quantities of silver and gold. Parikshit Maharaj later asks about this, and Sukadev Goswami replies. Om Ajnana Chimirandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So, I was giving class a couple of weeks ago where Lord Shiva humbly asked to see the Mohini Murti of Krishna. And since then, things have steadily been going from bad to worse. We've had scattered hair, trembling breasts, and saris flying off in the wind, and now Lord Shiva is walking around bewildered, and I'm thinking, is this the right book we're reading here? But it is. It is the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavad Purana. We have to remember we are on Canto 8 here, so we have to put on our transcendental glasses. The situation is, as I think I also started out last time, is that Lord Shiva is actually not in Maya. We are. That's the problem. We're the one who is perverting these things. This is actually a transcendental pastime. It is described also that Lord Shiva, he knows that this is all a game. This is all theater. We don't. We think it's real, all this that's going on. We identify with it. So the point is that even though Lord Shiva knows it's a game, he is still under the control of the potency of the Lord. Now the point of this is, and this will be explained later, that actually the Mohini Murti is leading Lord Shiva around all these places so all the rishis can see that even the greatest of the devotees, Lord Shiva, is absolutely helpless to the attractive feature, the attractive potency of the Lord. So in that way, it serves as an example. I mean, so that's the rishis, what to speak of us. So we should never think that we can control the energy and the potency of the Lord. Even though we may know what is going on, we are still under the influence, and we are still dependent. So when we are discussing these things, the tendency is to say that, okay, so then it's an example. It's not literal, right? It's symbolic. So then it's not actually real. No, that's not, because then we start to think of it as myth, and then we can distance ourselves from it. This is the jnani tendency. And we should be careful about that, because we should take this absolutely literal. What it isn't is it's not mundane. We're mundane. We have mundane consciousness. That's why we're chanting, and that's why we're purifying ourselves and listening to Bhagavatam, to get rid of this mundane tendency. So that's the karmi aspect. And all the problems that we face, and actually the reason that we're in the material world, is because we have this tendency to go either karma or jnana on reality. So the jnana aspect is that, well, material means suffering. All suffering comes from the material. So if I just remove myself from the material, suffering will end, and then I will be happy. Now the karmic aspect is that, okay, material is suffering comes from material. Therefore, I must control the material, and then I will be happy. Sadly, none of them work out, because we can't control the material. We see how Lord Shiva is walking around bewildered here. And he is, I think we can easily say, much more qualified than we are. There's absolutely no way we can control the material energy. And we just have to look around us to see how, I mean, every day we're reminded. And the Jnani aspect, well, to a certain extent, it is possible to remove yourself from the material energy, but there is the small problem that the soul is inherently active, so you have to deal with something. If you just remove yourself, then you're just kind of hanging there in the Brahma Jyoti, and if you're not attached to some higher principle, then when the soul regains this activity, it has to regain it in relation to something it knows, and then that's the material. So it just goes back to the material, and the samsara of material life continues. So this is all because of false ego, ahankara. This is what keeps us here. We have this false identification with matter. I am this matter. There are levels of ignorance, you could say. First of all, lack of knowledge is not a problem. You could say that is ignorance in the mode of goodness. Lack of knowledge. We are minute. We are the smallest energy of Krishna, the Tathasta Shakti, which means that we don't know everything. Of course we don't. But that's not a problem. As long as we are aware of that and we work with that, then we can ask the proper authorities and don't go around doing something stupid. Stupid is the second level of ignorance. It is connected with activity. So you can say that stupid is more along the lines of the mode of passion, ignorance in the mode of passion. Actually, I was supposed to be on a plane right now heading for Spain. But somehow or other, I managed to book my ticket for September instead of August. That's stupid. But it's not necessarily ignorant, because ignorance, it's from the root word to ignore. And if you're in a room and you're ignoring someone, it means that you know they're there, you're just ignoring them. So ignorance means that you know that something is wrong, you're just not dealing with it. I was completely unaware of what I was doing when I was booking that ticket. But if you actually know that something is wrong, like say you know that actually you cannot control the material energy because you're reminded every day, but you refuse to accept it, that is ignorance, and that is what makes the whole world upside down. Because then you have to start explaining why you're not dealing properly, and that makes for some interesting situations sometimes. When you have false ego of being the controller and enjoyer, you will necessarily work in what is called sakam, with desire, with lust, because you see it as yours. I'm the center, I'm the controller, this is mine. So that means you're attached to the result. It's my result. I want to control it. But it's not your result, that's the fact. So you, whatever you get attached to, you have to let go of it at some point. Everything material is temporary. That is one of the one of the things connected with anything material is that it's temporary. Our bodies are temporary, our everything we have, we just have it for some time and then it degrades. You buy a new car and it's already falling apart when you drive out of the shop. It's just a matter of time. So, sorry about that. So if you're not able to actually deal with it, if your false ego is too big, then you have to figure out some kind of explanation. So what you usually say is that, well, I may not be religious or pious or anything, but at least I'm honest. So instead of trying to meet the standard, you just lower the standard. That's something that we hear often from materialists, that, well, at least we're honest, you know. At least I'm not pretending. At least I'm not lying like these religious types who try to be all holy and all that, but they still have all these material desires. So actually, I'm better because I'm honest about my total svayam self-centeredness. So you sacrifice a higher principle for a lower, and you justify it by the lower principle. And this is the tendency. I mean, we see that in persons, we also see it in societies. that, okay, we're in Kali Yuga, so society is degrading, people are not following Varnashram, they're living like animals, so what do? All the four vices, we just make them legal. And then we say, we're a free country. You know, pornography, drinking and smoking and gambling and all these things, we just make it legal and hey, we're a free country. Everybody decides for themselves, this is good. And meanwhile, people are getting addicted and they're gambling their house away and getting divorced and all these things are going on. But hey, that's people's own responsibility. We're free. So the problem is that people do not know what is going on inside their head. We know from Shastra that the gross is a result of the subtle. This whole temple is here because of consciousness. George Harrison was very favorable towards the Krishna consciousness movement, so he purchased this house. Before that, someone built this house with an idea. The subtle is driving the gross. So if you don't know what is going on inside your subtle body, how can you know anything about what's going on in the gross material manifestation? Atheistic scholar, he will say, well, we're scientific. But everything that he measures in his laboratory goes through one more instrument that he doesn't actually realize, and that's his own mind. Now, if he doesn't know how that works, how will he know anything about what's going on outside? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he explains to us that there are five processes of the mind. First of all, the senses, they're always active. There is no controlling the senses. When we say control the senses, we mean control the mind. And then the mind shuts off the senses and turns them on. The senses themselves are uncontrolled, so they're constantly feeding the mind with information. That's process number one. Then the mind takes that information and boils it down to one thing. See, the mind can only do one thing. It's attraction or rejection. That's what the mind does. So it takes all these things and boils them down to one thing, positive or negative. Third process, the intelligence takes all these things and plays around with them, combines them, divides them, what is similar, what is different, what are the options here? But it doesn't do anything. That's the false ego. That's the fourth process. The false ego looks at the options that the intelligence are giving and then makes a decision based on what do I identify with. I'm sitting here because I was asked to give class, and because I'm a brahmachari, I'm studying shastra, I identify with that situation, so I say yes. If someone asks me if I want to help them carve some meat, I will most likely say no, because I don't identify with that situation. And then the fifth process is, of course, when the false ego has identified with, okay, we go with this process, this is the most likely for whoever I am, then it activates the active senses, hands, voice, whatever. And then the cycle continues. So this is always going on inside us. But the atheistic scholar, if you try to talk with them about these things, I've tried it, it's quite fun sometimes, they have absolutely no idea. They know about intelligence, but they have no idea what is happening before and what is happening after. Now, in reality, what is happening before and what is happening after is much, much more important, because the intelligence doesn't actually do anything except theoretically. Now, the mind, whatever we feed the mind with, however we train the mind, that is going to determine what the intelligence has to work with. That is why we have put some weight on samskaras in the Vedic paradigm, because samskaras, it's like it cuts grooves in your consciousness. If you make some samskar, then you identify with some certain activities that in the Vedic paradigm are pious, are good for us. If not, then it will be more random. You see children growing up in alcoholic families, there is a tendency that they themselves become alcoholics, even though they've seen all the bad things that it leads to, because the samskar is there. The mind is not intelligent. It doesn't know what is to be done and what is not to be done, so it just gets used to whatever is there. So that is why we have ritual in the Vedic paradigm, and we have all these things written down in Shastra, because it's a way for us to actually control what how the mind reacts to all this input that we're getting. So an atheist, by definition, does not follow the Vedic paradigm. So whatever happens is just purely random. I'm studying at the University of Copenhagen now, and I have an assistant professor who's there, and he smokes cigarettes, and it's just baffling for me to come and actually take instructions from someone who doesn't even know that he's killing himself. You know, it's a little bit odd, but he doesn't have any authoritative samskaras. So it's just random. He's just addicted to his senses, and he doesn't know that that's what goes on. It's always, you hear the same thing. Smokers always say it. Well, it's a free country. I'll smoke if I like, if I want to. But do you want to, or does your conditioning want to? They don't know how to distinguish. And the same with the false ego. They think the false ego is the real ego because they think they are the body. So they think it's all real, this. So if you can't control these things, how are you going to know anything? That's the bottom line. They don't know anything. And I'm not, this is not figuratively speaking. This is literally, they have no knowledge. They have loads and loads of information. But they don't have knowledge, because knowledge means that you are able to combine the information correctly and apply it. If you can't apply it, it has no value. Then it's just mental speculation. And funnily enough, we see that often these types, they have absolutely no application into the real world. They never get outside the campus of the university, and they sit and discuss. Because if there is such a thing as application, then there's also consequence. So then you can measure, is it actually true or false what I'm doing? But that's not the point. The point is the speculation in itself, because that boosts the false ego. So if these things are not under control, you can't know anything. So that's why we're not impressed. And a good example of this is 20 years ago, a book came out, Forbidden Archaeology, by Dhrutakarma and Sataputta Prabhu. And I think 800 or 900 cases debunked the whole world history as the modern paradigm knows it, using exactly the same methods as the atheistic scholars are using to determine that humans are only 100,000 years old. They determined that there's evidence of human activity millions of years back. And what happened? Absolutely nothing. Because the false ego of the atheist does not identify with this is not true. It identifies with this is true. So when the proof comes that it's not true, they just ignore it. In the book, they call it the knowledge filter. Yeah. I would take it even further and say it's the information filter. Anything that points in a different direction than what they will accept, they just ignore it. And as we know, ignorance comes from to ignore. That is the definition of ignorance. It's not my opinion. It's just fact. And when you discuss with them, it's funny, because as we were just saying, ignore, ignore, ignore. And if you push them, attack. And what's that? That's not the intelligence. That's the mind. Attraction or rejection. So this is what we're up against. In order to try and deal with it, is important to try and see what is actually the difference in culture here. Because if we have to engage these people, my Guru Maharaj said to me that my service to him is to study and engage these people. So that's why I like this topic. So bear with me. If we have to engage these people with these gigantic false egos, it helps to know something about the culture, or lack of. But Vaishnava culture is an inclusive culture with a very high standard. This means that there's room for everyone. You can be a scholar, you can be a worker, you could be an administrator, Vaishya, whatever kind of personality you have, we have something for everyone. Whatever inclination you have, you can engage that in Krishna service. Everybody is included. And we know, at least on a theoretical level, that the whole social hierarchy is just a game. Just like Lord Shiva here knows that this is just a game, we also know that all of this giving the class or managing the temple or making the money, and it's just actually a theater. Like Nandan Prabhu and Gurudas Prabhu, they're doing a theater now for Janmashtami. And this will be performed. And when you do a theater, it's important that everyone plays their role. It's not going to work if someone just looks at the manuscript and says, well, I like that line, and this line over here is also good, even though it's two different people saying it, but I like him, so I'm just going to play those lines. It's not going to work. You have to play your part. If you play your part, it doesn't matter if it's a small part or it's a big part, because it's about the play. It's about who's actually receiving this. And for us, all that's going on here, it's for Krishna. So it doesn't actually matter if we have the big role of manager or temple president, or we're just washing the pots. Because that's just the mundane theater of social hierarchy. That's just going on so we can think of Krishna. That's the only, and I mean only, purpose that we're doing it, is so we can always remember Krishna and never forget him. All the other things, we were talking yesterday, we were on the fields working, and we were talking yesterday that actually it's quite satisfying just moving stuff around compared to, say, being a boss of 30 people. You know, but why do we want to have this authoritative role and play that role? It's always trouble. In the Gurukul in Mayapur, when we discuss problems with these dealings, 98% of the time, it's the temple president that is used as the example. But what if the temple president does this and it's unfair and I want to do, you know? Imagine how much harassment the temple president gets. Why are we so hung up on that position? Because we're contaminated by mundane consciousness. We want to be in the center. That's the sad truth. But, I mean, we have a lot of practice, millions of lives and all that, so it's all good. And we have to also remember that 20 years of Krishna consciousness is not actually a long time compared to that. So we're good, but we just need to sometimes remind ourselves that these tendencies, these materialistic tendencies, they are everywhere. It's universal tendencies. So when we see them in the atheistic scholar, it's swayam, it's full manifestation. But they still exist in us also. So that's why it's very lucky that we have an inclusive culture with a high standard. Now, an inclusive culture with a high standard means that you don't actually need to meet the standard. It's okay that you kind of fall short sometimes, because the standard, in Vedic terms, is perfection. This confuses the materialist a lot, because the standard in material consciousness is very low. The material culture is an exclusive culture with a very low standard. Why? Because it's very good for the false ego. If the false ego is told that I'm above the standard, then the false ego feels good. So if you get a standard ticket for the train, it's low class. If you get the standard room, it's the low class. You need the suite or the exclusive, presidential something, you know, something extra all the time. And if you don't have something absolute to attach that to, I mean, we have Krishna, that's the absolute, and we're all in relation to that. But the materialists, they don't have that. So since authority also is a universal principle, you cannot do anything without authority. You cannot do like we're doing the festival. Imagine if everyone just walked around doing whatever they felt like. There would be no festival. So there has to be established somehow some kind of hierarchy. That is where the exclusivity comes in. You exclude others, and those who are left, they are deciding. You know, some get voted into the Congress or the government or whatever, some don't. Some progress in the X Factor television program, some don't. Some can get into the VIP area of the whatever it is they're doing, some can't. So it's an exclusive culture with a low standard. And that's what confuses them, because when they see our standard, they're looking at something they can never meet. I mean, not even close. The whole value of their life is the four vices. And we start out by saying, you can't do that. You know? So, I mean, they're not even going to try. So we have to understand this, because otherwise we can't actually approach them. But it helps to know that there is only one time we actually have to meet the standard. And that's at the time of death. Until then, it's just practice. That's what sadhana means. It means practice. We're practicing. We're trying. Being a Vaishnava actually means trying to be a Vaishnava. Following the footsteps of the great acharyas who were and are Vaishnavas. We're just trying to tag along. And that's the glory of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that he said, it's okay. This is Kali Yuga. You're all messed up in the head. Come along. You know, do whatever you can. It would be much better. See, the counterpoint would then be, but how can you preach when you can't even follow? Right? But we have to. These South Indian brahmanas, they're not doing it. You know? So we have to do it. So that's the situation. And our philosophy is transcendental. It's a higher dimension of reality. So that means that you can go from anywhere to anywhere within that. You can't do that with mundane. So that is maybe where we have an advantage. We can take, Prabhupada was expert at this. Whoever he was speaking with, you just start with where they are and then you draw it to Krishna. It can be done very smoothly and very elegantly. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Gaurin Sai ki. I'll give you an example. Sanskrit grammar is, the nouns have 8 different grammatical cases. Now, let's take the first 3 of them, just to keep it simple, and say that we want to explain how to become a pure devotee only using grammatical terms. So first grammatical term is the subject, then there is the object, and the third is the instrument. A sentence would be, I start the car with the key. I am the subject, the car is the object, and the key is the instrument. So, the materialist thinks that he is the subject, and the world is the object. So, we know that Krishna is actually the subject. He's the doer, he's the controller. And the devotees are the object. So this is why the atheist thinks that he's being objective. He thinks he's the subject, so he thinks he's objective. Actually, there is no such thing as people being objective. Everything we do is subjective. Everything Krishna does is objective. Because we're the object and Krishna's the subject. So then you have the neophyte devotee thinks, Krishna, okay, I'm the object. Great. And the other devotees are the instrument for me to do my devotion. Actually, that's the reverse. So that's the advanced devotee, the Madhyam or the Uttama Adhikari, is that Krishna is the subject, the other devotees are the object, and I'm just the instrument for Krishna's appreciation of the other devotees. That's advanced devotion. So this is just grammatical terms, and you have the whole philosophy in there. You can go further and take the other 5 grammatical cases, and you can actually put the whole Panchatattva in there and describe the whole Panchatattva only using grammatical cases. Also with the cosmic manifestation, you can do this. It's going to be very technical, so I'm not going to go into details with it. But try to imagine that you say to a materialist, try to explain the Big Bang only using grammatical terms. He's just going to think you're a fool. And that's what they do. They think we're fools because they don't understand that it's a higher reality. We work with principles, and the principles manifest here and there and everywhere. And if we know what is the principle and what is the detail, that means that we can apply anything anywhere. So that is why, just as another example, if you're giving class and you get a couple of verses that can be construed as pretty gross and perverted, you can just talk about what is Maya, what is ignorance, and what is, and dick, 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 and then Sanskrit grammar, and before you know it, nobody remembers what the verses were about anyway, so you're home free. So it's very practical like that. But an atheist can't do that. If you take psychoanalysis, it can only do one thing. The only thing it can do is to say that you're in love with your mother. That's the only thing, that's the same conclusion it always comes back to. Because it's mundane, it's only a detail. It fits into the whole thing in a very kind of sick, weird way. But it's only a detail, so it can't be projected onto anything else. He, Freud in this case, can only describe his own illness and then compare others to it. So that's why when you see self-help books, they keep coming out. Why? Because they don't work. Because they only work on the specific detail that it's describing right now. 2 years later, it's a different situation, and it just doesn't apply. Bhagavatam, 5,000 years, still as fresh as ever. It always applies. It's transcendental. It's not subject to time, subject to change. That's the difference. That's why we're happy, they're not. This can be measured. If you just measure it like any other thing you would be measuring, we're happy, they're not. It's a fact. We live longer, we live healthier, we're smiling more, we're dancing, chanting, feasting. Everything is nice. They're not, because they're always fighting the material energy. And that's the secondary point of these two verses, actually. See, the first point is pretty obvious, that we can see that if Lord Vishnu cannot control himself, forget it, don't even try, don't even try to control yourself, just engage yourself in the right things instead of the wrong things. You have to be attached to something, you will be led around by something, so let it be Krishna and not the mundane energy. So in this point, the secondary point is very intelligent and very interesting, I think, is because that Lord Shiva, he's even though this looks very mundane, he's still doing devotional service because he knows it's a game and it is Krishna. And he's when he realizes what has been going on, he glorifies Krishna. So we have to remember to separate the mundane from the spiritual. There is the verse in Bhagavad Gita, Abhichet Suturacharo, whatever abominable activities you're engaged in, if you're engaged in devotional service, you're still saintly because you are fixed in your determination, something like that, right? And that's the important thing here, that it's not actually mundane and perverted. It's actually just you're forgetting yourself in the service of Krishna, so whatever happens, it just happens. And even total waste, in this case the semen, for the devotee on a mundane platform is glorious. It becomes gold and silver. And Prabhupada explains here in the purport that those who worship Vishnu are often rewarded with riches, even though he lives under a bale tree, he doesn't even construct a house. Because that's how the material energy works. If you want it, you can't have it. If you don't want it, it's all yours. That's why Prabhupada, he could go to America and start a world religion with a fistful of rupees. What's he going to do with rupees over there? But the material world, the material energy, just allows him to do it because he doesn't want it, because he realized that the material energy is a tool for the worship of Krishna. It's not an end in itself. As soon as it becomes an end in itself, that's when the problem starts. That's when we try to control it, and we can't do that. That's when it draws away from us. So if we try to be the masculine, that's when the problem starts. We can see like if a man is pursuing a woman, if he's too anxious, if he's too attached, if he wants it too much, she's not going to have anything to do with him. But if he's cool and calm and collected, then he can do it. So it's the same way with us and the material energy. If we renounce that, the idea that it's for our benefit, then it's all there for us. Now, check out where we are now. Who lives in this building? Monks. We don't even have a bank account, some of us, you know. But look how opulently we're living, because it's not ours. It's Krishna's. And we're serving. And the servant lives as opulently as the king. He's walking around the palace and he has all the facilities there, and he can do that because he's serving, because he doesn't consider it his. Prabhupada also gives the example of the guy who works in the bank. All this money is just there for him because he doesn't consider it his. So that's how these things work. Let's see if I have some... I think that was something I forgot. I think I got through everything. Any questions?